Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jerome Pawn of the National Lawyers Guild, who looks at the congressional debate on renewal of controversial provisions of the U.S. Patriot Act. Lisa Hogard of the Latin America Working Group, who examines the human rights situation in Colombia's ongoing civil war. And Joel Bleifuss, editor of In These Times magazine, who discusses his investigation into continuing questions surrounding the legitimacy of the 2004 presidential election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Jean Ziegler, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, has sharply criticized U.S. military tactics in Iraq. In a report filed with the UN Human Rights Commission, Ziegler expressed concern with the recent U.S. blockade of Fallujah that halted food shipments and caused the destruction of water reservoirs in its campaign to force out insurgents. At a late March press conference in Geneva, the UN official insisted that denial of food and water violate the Geneva Conventions. According to Agence France-Presse, Ziegler condemns the serious humanitarian consequences of the strategy and military tactics applied since March 2003 by the occupying forces. The report also cited the acute malnutrition of Iraqi children under the age of 5, which has nearly doubled since Saddam Hussein was forced from power. U.S. Ambassador Kevin Moley rejected the idea that hunger in Iraq had increased since the 2003 military invasion. Moley claimed that malnutrition rates in Iraq were lower than throughout the Arab world. Overall, the Ziegler reports show that the World Food Program, in all its operations, cut food rations by a third in February 2004, bringing them below the minimum international standards for nutrition levels. The decrease in aid may lead to more deaths in refugee camps in Africa. In conclusion, Ziegler blamed the cut in food assistance on the reallocation of resources to wage war on terrorism and increase funding for national security. Mexican politics boiled over in the streets as the National Congress voted overwhelmingly to allow prosecutors to go after popular Mexico City Mayor Manuel López Obrador, the likely presidential candidate of the left-leaning party of the Democratic Revolution. In the face of a rally of over 100,000 people supporting Mayor López Obrador, Congress voted 360 to 127 in early April to strip away the mayor's criminal immunity from prosecution and permit his arrest over a small legal violation involving a 2001 land dispute. The populist Mexico City mayor, who is currently leading the polls for the 2006 Mexican presidential election, urged his supporters to wage a peaceful campaign of civil resistance as he awaits his arrest and imprisonment. Mexico's current president, Vicente Fox, of the pro-business PAN party, is prevented by term limits from running for re-election. According to the London-based Independent newspaper, the arrest of Mayor López Obrador could work to his political advantage. He could join the long list of pro-democracy campaigners across the globe to win power. As he told the Mexican Congress before storming out, "I am proud to be accused. Today you are judging me, but don't forget that history will judge the both of us." The Inuit, the native people of the Arctic, are preparing to file a case with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights against the United States, accusing Washington of being the leading culprit behind global warming. In recent years, the Arctic has seen a significant temperature rise, leading to melting sea ice and the loss of the permafrost layer of the soil, forcing several Inuit villages to relocate. According to the Interpress Service, the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, a recent four-year study, predicted that over the next 50 years, polar bears, walrus, and some seal species, animals that the Inuit rely upon for their cultural survival, could become extinct. To pressure the Bush administration to act on climate change, the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, representing over 150,000 indigenous people, will soon file its human rights petition with the Inter-American Commission. Even if the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights rules in the Inuit's favor, it cannot force the U.S. government to change its policy on global warming. But in the court of public opinion, a victory could increase the pressure on the Bush administration to adopt limits on the production of greenhouse gases. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski. We'll be right back.
Since Congress adopted the controversial USA Patriot Act 45 days after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, the nation has been divided on the far-reaching legislation that critics maintain erodes American civil liberties and constitutional protections. Congress is now reviewing 16 provisions of the Patriot Act, which expire at the end of 2005. Among the sections of the Patriot Act under scrutiny are the library provision, which permits the government to secretly seize personal records and documents from libraries, bookstores, businesses, and hospitals. Those asked for such records can be prosecuted if they divulge the request. Other sections that will not expire this year, such as the sneak and peek provision, have drawn criticism for allowing secret government searches of a suspect's home with only delayed notification to the owner. Since its adoption, five state legislatures and 375 cities and towns across the U.S. have passed resolutions condemning the Patriot Act. Now, a coalition of progressive and conservative groups are campaigning to reveal key provisions of the legislation. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Jerome Pawn, treasurer of the National Lawyers Guild, who examines the widespread concerns over controversial elements of the USA Patriot Act.
There are a number of provisions that are scheduled to sunset unless Congress takes action, but quite frankly, some of the more invidious sections of the Act are not scheduled to sunset, and people need to be concerned about that. I think that many legislatures, both of the conservative and of the liberal ilk, are concerned about it and are now susceptible, at least, to talking about those provisions as well as the ones that are scheduled to sunset. There are 16 provisions, by the way, that are scheduled to sunset. Some of the ones that we hope will go away, I suspect won't actually go away, but will get perhaps amended. But I think that that may be true as well, and I think that people should be willing to take an opportunity here to get Congress to review the entire Act, or at least the provisions of it that are most onerous. I mean, the provisions that I think that people should be concerned about are, for instance, provisions 215 and 218 of the Patriot Act deal with the federal government's ability to secure essentially warrantless searches. Originally, what these two sections did was they enhanced provisions that were already in law under FISA, which is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Under FISA, before the Patriot Act, the government had the ability to conduct some warrantless searches, but they had to be against agents of a foreign government or a foreign government organization. They were not authorized against United States citizens or other individuals, and the purpose had to be primarily for anti-terrorism or national security reasons. Under what the Patriot Act did was to expand that power so that now the purpose does not need to be primarily for national security interests, but just has to have a significant contributing factor in that direction. So it's a considerably more broad definition that allows a broader application of warrantless searches and surveillance in general. Those provisions are, or at least some of them, are scheduled to sunset. I don't expect that they actually will, but certainly there should be some outcry about reining these in and getting some judicial oversight.
Could you comment a little bit on the sneak and peek provisions that have raised a lot of concern in terms of civil liberties?
That, by the way, is not scheduled to sunset. What the sneak and peek provisions do, although the government is required to get the search warrant, they don't have to show it to the person they're executing the search on. And in fact, they say, and it's not clear, actually, to my knowledge at least, how long they have. At least at one point, Attorney General Ashcroft, former Attorney General Ashcroft, said that they didn't have to show anybody the warrant for maybe in excess of a year. The idea here is that the federal government can get the sneak and peek search warrant under Section 213, and they can come into your house, your business, your car, whatever, your property, and take pictures, copy hard drives, do all kinds of surveillance on you, and you may never even know about it because they may do it when you're not there, and they don't have to tell you that they were there. And you may or may not ever find out. At some point, presumably, they are supposed to provide you with a copy of the warrant. And, of course, if you don't have a copy of the warrant, you can't object to the warrant, and you also can't go into court to try and quash the warrant to protect your rights, because you don't even know it's been issued. It seems to me a particularly dangerous provision of the Act, especially since this kind of surveillance was used for many years and found illegal by Congress years and years ago after the now infamous COINTELPRO operation became widely publicized when it was learned that American citizens, including civil rights leaders and anti-war protesters, were simply being surveilled by the FBI and the CIA because they had views contrary to the prevailing administration views.
Jerome Pawn, have some of these provisions in the Patriot Act made the country safer despite their controversial nature in terms of cutting back on our civil liberties?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, and I'd like to be able to answer that one way or another, and my gut tells me that, no, they haven't made us at least much safer, because there's so many things in it that have stripped our civil rights that I don't think you make a country safer by taking away liberties. But the reality is, we don't know, because the FBI and the Justice Department and the CIA have hidden and refuse to provide even Congress with information that tells us exactly how they've used various portions of the Act. So that kind of secretive behavior by the government that covers up abuses, I don't think strengthens the United States. I think it makes us more vulnerable. I don't think it strengthens democracy, and I think that democracy is the thing that does need to be strengthened here. We talk about it being so necessary in Iraq and Afghanistan. We need to practice what we preach here in the United States.
That was Jerome Pawn, treasurer of the National Lawyers Guild. Contact the Guild by calling area code 212-627-2656 or visit their website at www.nlg.org. The war in Colombia has almost disappeared from U.S. corporate media coverage, even as several other countries in Latin America, such as Brazil, Bolivia and Venezuela, have become the new focus of press attention. But a civil war is still raging in Colombia, as it has for more than 40 years, killing tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians. The armed groups involved in the combat include the Colombian Army, the right-wing paramilitary group United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, or AUC, closely allied with the Army, and two major guerrilla groups, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, and the National Liberation Army, or ELN. The U.S. is intimately linked with the war, as it has given $700 million a year in aid to the government of Colombian President Alvaro Uribe, purportedly to stamp out production of coca, from which cocaine is derived. The so-called Plan Colombia was initiated by the Clinton administration and continues under President Bush. 80% of the U.S. funding given to Bogota is military aid. In the midst of the war, a number of small rural communities have declared themselves combat-free zones, but the various factions don't necessarily respect their wishes. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Lisa Hogard, executive director of the Latin America Working Group, based in Washington, D.C., about the human rights situation in Colombia, where many civilians are caught between combating forces and the status of the U.S.-funded Plan Colombia.
President Uribe has taken a very hardline approach to the war, and his position really has been either you're with us or you're against us. And initially, I think he got very considerable support from the Colombian populace, particularly people in the cities who are very tired of the war and very angry at the leftist guerrillas, the FARC, for their practice of kidnapping, which really affected many Colombians. However, his hardline approach has also meant that the Army's human rights record has really deteriorated over these years rather than improved. And I just want to get back a moment to the whole idea of this aid package in the beginning in the year 2000. The idea was that by 6 years, the level of coca was supposed to be way down. the human rights record of the Army was supposed to have been improved, the rule of law was supposed to have been strengthened, and peace would be closer at hand. And right now what we see is that there continues to be a very severe human rights crisis in Colombia, and it continues to be one of the countries in the world where their most internally displaced people who have to flee violence. The human rights record of the military in particular has gotten worse in certain ways, especially through direct violations and allegations of extrajudicial executions and use of torture. And there have been waves of detentions that have captured people who probably were not involved in the conflict. There have been arbitrary detentions. Well, the figures last year for the year 2004 for COCA was that after the largest aerial spraying campaign, which the United States funds ever in Colombia, the level of COCA is exactly the same as it was at the beginning of the year. And this gets to the main problem with Plan Colombia, which is that it's putting all its resources on the side of military force or forced eradication, the spraying, rather than on the social side in terms of alternative development programs for small farmers so that they can grow something other than coca, because of course they should not be growing coca.
But I understand that both the Clinton and Bush administrations have touted their assistance to Colombian peasants to grow alternative crops.
Certainly it's happening, and that is the part of the assistance that we do support. But it is a small fraction of what is needed, and all of those programs together are only 20% of the aid package. To give you an example, the United States is funding the aerial spraying campaign, and the reason we are concerned with this is both for environmental reasons, but also because when they do the spraying campaign, they destroy people's food crops as well as the coca. And so they basically leave families without food as this happens, instead of helping them to turn to new crops.
I know that most of the violence is in the rural areas, but how do the peasants experience the war?
The way that it appears to people in the countryside is that they will have the leftist guerrillas come through, threaten and kill them and make them pay payments to them. Then they will have the right-wing paramilitaries come through and kill them and threaten them and accuse them of being related to the guerrillas. And then they might have the army come through and detain them and otherwise, you know, not protect them. And so people are just totally caught in the middle of the conflict by all the different actors, and they really have no recourse.
In February, 8 residents of a peace community in Colombia were murdered, including 4 children. What are these peace communities in a country at war? And is it known who is responsible for the murders?
It's a very interesting development of people trying in different ways to stay out of the conflict. And we have both the peace communities who ask all the armed actors, including the army, to stay out of their territories and to respect them. And you also have indigenous peoples who do the same. Witnesses from the community say that the people who did the killing identified themselves as being with the army. And there are a number of other circumstances surrounding this that really point towards the army. I have to say, one never knows in an investigation until a complete, transparent investigation has taken place. But that is where things are pointing at this moment.
That was Lisa Hogart of the Latin America Working Group. For more information on how to participate in a call-in day for Colombia on April 26th, asking members of Congress to reallocate aid for civilian needs, contact the working group at area code 202-546-7010 or visit their website at www.lawg.org. unlike the extended dispute that plagued the 2000 presidential election between Al Gore and George W. Bush, Democratic Party candidate John Kerry conceded the 2004 race for the White House rather quickly. However, in the months after the November 4th ballot, citizen groups in the battleground state of Ohio launched protests and convened hearings demanding an investigation into allegations of vote count irregularities and Republican Party efforts to suppress the turnout of Democratic voters. But now, 5 months after his quiet exit from the presidential election contest, Senator John Kerry has raised the issue of voter intimidation and GOP dirty tricks, while stating that he does not believe these irregularities would have changed the result. Speaking to the Massachusetts League of Women Voters on April 10th, Kerry charged that many of his supporters were denied access to the polls through the use of misleading leaflets and telephone calls. Several issues regarding the 2004 election still continue to cause many citizens to be skeptical about the results. Contradictions between exit polls and the final vote tally and anomalies of electronic voting machine totals are the subject of a forthcoming book by investigative journalist Joel Blyfus and statistician Stephen Freeman. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Blyfus, editor of In These Times magazine, who discusses his investigation into continuing questions surrounding the legitimacy of the 2004 presidential election.
Two issues surrounding the election, and Kerry touched on one of them with his comments to the League of Women Voters, and that is the sort of legal fraud, legal in the sense that secretaries of state can do it and there are no consequences. And this is the sort of vote suppression tactics that he was referring to, and they were extremely widespread, especially in Florida and Ohio in 2004, and undoubtedly they did affect the vote somewhat. And while the book that my co-author Stephen Freeman and I are writing examines and explores some of those sort of what we call legal fraud, the vote suppression tactics, the thrust, pretty much the complete thrust of our book is examining the discrepancy between the official count, the official tally, and what the exit polls had predicted on Election Day.
What's your guess as to what happened with the exit polls and the explanation why the discrepancy, why Kerry lost the vote that, according to those polls, he should have won?
Our thesis, and we don't have proof of this besides the, I mean, in a sense, the exit polls are the proof, and one can examine the claims by Matosky and Edison that there was this preference of Kerry voters to speak to pollsters and a reluctance of Bush voters to do so. So we present the thesis that there's a possibility that what are called DRE, which are like touchscreen voting machines, electronic voting machines, either, which are used in about 30% of all polling places around the United States, have the possibility to be tampered with. And therefore, since the explanation that the exit polls are wrong does not hold up under any examination, one has to begin looking at the possibility that there was electoral fraud through rigging of these electronic voting machines, which leave no paper ballot.
Congressman John Conyers of Michigan conducted hearings in Ohio, and there were charges that the allocations of voting machines were deliberately skewed to Republican strongholds and away from Democratic Party strongholds.
That was absolutely true. I mean, there were people who had to wait 9 hours in line, 8 hours, 7 hours, in various heavily Democratic areas of the state. And obviously, many people went to vote but didn't wait. I don't know that a case can be made that there were enough votes that were suppressed to turn the election. I mean, obviously, it contributed something. But I think what's more indicative of this sort of widespread voter suppression on the part of Secretary of State Blackwell in Ohio is that it indicates the mentality of the GOP in dealing with elections. You look at what happened with Catherine Harris back in 2000. There's, in a sense, an institutionalization or an institutional acceptance on the part of the Republicans that you win an election by whatever means necessary. And I see in Florida and in Ohio in 2004, there was, you know, exactly a sort of they ramped up what had been done in 2000 in Florida. In some ways, what it indicates is that the United States, and this is what observers, international observers, remarked in 2004, that this is the only advanced industrial democracy that has such a chaotic voting system. I mean, Each state has its own. There's not a constitutional right to vote first in the Constitution. It's a state's right. And each state, you know, determines how votes are cast. And within the state, the county election supervisors have a lot of leeway in deciding that. So you have this sort of ad hoc, huge voting system that has no central sort of standards or laws or regulations. And so it becomes very vulnerable to manipulation.
Are you hopeful that there will be any accountability for what was done on the part of, let's say, Mr. Blackwell, the Secretary of State of Ohio, or, you know, going back to Catherine Harris? It may be too late now to catch up with her, but are you at all of the opinion that people down the line will be held accountable for what may have happened, some deliberate kind of efforts at voter suppression or juggling the vote tallies?
I'm not sure if sort of past errors will be remedied or justice brought in those cases. But, I mean, what we can do now is just demand and try to work to ensure that we have a transparent electoral system where there is not a question of to whether the winner won or lost, but it is just, you know, the people have faith that the system works for them, the democratic process. I think that the facts, in a sense, are on our side, and I would just expect that once people begin to realize this, that there'll be greater demands on the parts of both Democrats and Republicans for clean elections. You know, it's an awfully big step for people to mentally consider the fact that an election was stolen through vote fraud, because, you know, that's just so un-American, and, you know, who would ever do anything like that? And I think there's a reluctance on the part of the media, particularly, to examine this. And part of that is, you know, there's sort of an established conventional wisdom, and that has become that, well, the exit polls were off, but we can explain it because there was a differential in how Republicans and Democrats responded to the exit polls. Well, that's just doesn't hold up, and I think once people begin to realize that, they might pay more attention to the flaws in the electronic voting system we have.
That was Joel Bleifuss, editor of In These Times magazine and co-author of the forthcoming book, Was the 2004 Presidential Election Stolen? Read Bleifuss's articles online at www.inthesetimes.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.vtlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.